Today, we are thrilled to welcome Bob Siegel to the show to discuss his brand new show right here on the CGM Radio Network. We discuss his story of conversion from atheist to Christian, his ministry and calling as a pastor and Christian apologist, his radio experience from the past 15 years, and what his show is going to be like here on the network. Plus, we talk some news. This is World News Brief by CGM Radio. And welcome to this Friday, May 29th, 2020 edition of World News Brief, where we bring you, our amazing listeners, a wrap-up of the most impactful and relevant news around the world from the past week. I am your host, Winston R. Holland, delighted to be with you as always. And we have a very special edition this week. We're welcoming Bob Siegel to the show for just a fascinating interview. Bob is the newest member of the CGM Radio Network family. And we're going to get into his past, how he became the speaker and the activist and Christian apologist and pastor and all the really neat things that he is. We get into all of that. But first, make sure you're following me on Twitter and Facebook at World News CGM. And remember, any articles and anything we discuss in this show will be in the show notes, including Bob's information. Also, email me world@cgmradio.com. Without further ado, here is my interview with Bob Siegel. Well, to kick off the show today, I am thrilled to welcome Bob Siegel via Zoom, a graduate of Denver Seminary and San Jose State University. Bob Siegel is an author, columnist, radio talk show host, pastor, and public speaker. Over a period of many years, Bob has ministered to churches and college campuses across the country using a variety of media, including seminaries, formal debates, open outdoor forums, and one-man drama presentations. So he is quite the Renaissance man. Bob Siegel, welcome to World News Brief.
Ryan, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me on. Well, and thank you for inviting me to be a part of your network in general.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I am just thrilled. I'm not only the host of World News Brief, but I'm also the CEO and founder of the CGM Radio Network. And as such, I am particularly beside myself to announce that you have joined CGM as one of our weekly show hosts. And it's kind of a long story of how that happened, and I want to get into that. But first, why don't we introduce your show, and then we'll take a step back and discuss your story, because it really is a fascinating one. So if you would, first tell us what your show is all about and what people can expect to hear here on the CGM Radio Network.
Well, the theme will sound like a simple one, but it actually gives me a very wide net. We call our theme Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture. So I am a Christian apologist. I love taking questions and doing talks on the historicity of the Bible and the resurrection, to some degree, archaeology. When you're an apologist, you're kind of a jack of all trades, master of none. If some people are unfamiliar with that word, whenever I go to speak somewhere and I'm introduced as an apologist, somebody always comes and makes a little joke. Well, you're not going to be apologizing for becoming a Christian, are you?
Yeah, right.
And I'll pretend I haven't heard it 8 zillion times before. Sure. And say, well, no, that word is actually a New Testament word. It comes from 1 Peter when he says, always be ready to give an answer to anybody who asks you the reason for the faith you have. An apologist is one who reasons things out with people. Usually these days when Christianity or any religion is talked about, people define the term faith in an incorrect way. Faith in their minds is, well, I have no idea whether God exists or whether Jesus exists, but hey, I know. I'll just go ahead and choose to believe in him anyway and live my life as though he does exist. And when my life is over, if it turns out there was a God, if it turns out there was a Jesus, God will reward me for having been so gullible and stupid. And I'll get to enter his kingdom. Well, that's not what the word faith meant in the days of the New Testament. That may be how Webster's and other dictionaries define it today, but faith meant trust. The writers of the New Testament assumed we could know for a fact that God existed. Let me say that again. They assumed we could know for a fact that God existed. Amen. For two reasons. One, the resurrection of Christ was a recorded event of history. The early apologists, and this is where the term apologist first became popular, was mentioned in the New Testament. It became popular in the second century when Christians were defending Christianity against the tyranny of Rome. They were defending it morally because they were accused of being traitors to the empire. They were defending it intellectually. There's a letter from Justin Martyr, an early Christian writer who wrote to the Roman Emperor Antoninus Pius. He said, if you have any doubt that this is true, that Christ rose from the dead, go check the annals of Pontius Pilate that are still in the imperial archives. Nobody's going to say that to a Roman emperor if he isn't very sure that that document exists.
Well, and that's truly
so
amazing.
So that's what a Christian apologist does.
It's amazing. You're not going to see this probably on many atheist forums, that a word such as apologia, where we get the term apologist, which is a word focusing on intellectualism and rationality and making a defense and philosophy, gained popularity because of Christianity, right? Because and so much of the idea what you'll see out there online, especially, is that Christianity is just a religion for the simple minded, for those who just want a crutch to lean on to get through a difficult life. It's kind of a fairy tale, Santa Claus in the sky, and so forth. But you're saying a word that focused on rationality and intellectualism was popularized by Christianity.
Absolutely. And I'm also saying that the word faith did not mean what it means today. So the early apologists, on one hand, would point to that objective evidence, the historicity of the resurrection. Of course, they were much closer historically to that time than we were, but we're already talking about 100 years back when Antoninus Pius, the Roman emperor, received that letter. But they also talked about the relationship we could have with the Holy Spirit. This is the mystical side of Christianity. In the letter of 1 John, he says, this is how we know we belong to him, by the Spirit he has given to us. So we can, when somebody says, can you prove to me that God exists? I said, I can't prove to you that God exists. You can't prove to me that God doesn't exist. You can prove it to yourself, because nothing is proven unless it's repeatable. You can experience God. You can have an encounter with God. So, Ryan, when I talk about the academia and the apologetics and the historicity of the resurrection, sometimes people will say, well, prove this. And then Christians give evidence. They may even give good evidence. They may even give fantastic evidence. But then they can switch gears and say, well, okay, that's still only evidence. That's not proof. Well, the evidence is a trail of breadcrumbs leading to God, but it is God himself who makes himself known. That part I can't do for people, obviously, but they can do that for themselves by seeking God. So that's the first part of what my show is all about, is that I am a Christian apologist who defends the Bible. And I love talking not only about its accuracy, but when people say, well, I read the Bible, I don't think he's a loving God. Why did we have those Old Testament wars? There are some people who think the Bible promotes slavery, which it doesn't. But there are verses which, if you take them out of context, certainly look like it does. So I'm also defending the Bible morally.
Incredible. Incredible. So, which I love that aspect of it. We have another show on the CGM Radio Network called Faith, Reason, Culture that where it's kind of gotten a slow start, but it's you know, kind of focused solely on that aspect of it. But your show is apologetics is a part of that. Now, what are some other subjects that the listeners can expect you to cover in the Bob Siegel show?
Good question. Truth is truth. And so it's not just what's true in the Bible, but that same passion leads me to look at the news of the day and what's going on culturally and comment on where we are as a country. And I'm just as passionate about defending our Constitution, particularly the First Amendment freedoms, but of course, all of it. So I like to talk quite a bit about the news as well. And then a third portion of my program is my background in drama. I've written a lot of plays. I've been in a lot of plays. I've directed a lot of plays. I write novels too. I love the arts. I'm very passionate about the arts. Sometimes I bring my movie critic friend on my program. Sometimes I myself just critique movies. Every year I replay my show where I do my top 10 favorite Christmas movies like It's a Wonderful Life. But then I just love talking about the worst two Christian movies that were ever made. Not Christian movies, Christmas movies, I meant to say. And so I'm very passionate about the arts as well. So from week to week, you might see a week that focuses all on the Bible, another week that focuses all on politics, another week that's all on the arts. Often it's a combination. So it just really depends.
Yeah, and I saw this past week you were talking politics. You were talking on last week's show. You were talking about the blasphemy of the Holy Spirit, and is that a sin that we can even commit today? I love the fact that you have satire and just some drama mixed in with social commentary and biblical knowledge. It really is a almost kind of like a Christian variety show. I don't know if you.
It is. It makes radio so much more fun to throw that in. And I should say that the more serious the subject, the more important it is to me to break it up with some humor, because I do think that lightening things up makes it more palatable. Also, humor will say things and communicate truth in a way that people might not have thought about it before if we're always just getting up at the podium.
Well, and you're making me want to employ more of that on my show, because when you're dealing with world news and so much of it is so difficult. Maybe I need to employ some more of that on my show, but I'm excited from what I've heard of the past few shows here on the CGM Radio Network. And by the way, if you want to subscribe to Bob's show, you can right now. Just go to cgmradio.com/Bob. And there will be links to subscribe to the show on various podcasting platforms, or really just open up your podcasting, your favorite podcasting app, search The Bob Siegel Show, and it should come up. I believe it's on all major platforms. The only two we're still waiting on would be Pandora and iHeartRadio. But any, you know, Apple, Google, Spotify, tune in. You can even say, Alexa, play the Bob Siegel Show podcast, and it'll come up. So I highly, highly encourage you guys to do that. So is there anything else you want to say, Bob, about the show before we dive in?
Yeah, I wanted to say, Ryan, that I hope that if they do ask Alexa, she won't go, I'm sorry, I have no information about a bozo named Bob Siegel.
Well, hey, with the way things are going, and you know as well as any of us about the social media wars that are happening right now in this country as we speak, most notably between Twitter and the President of the United States, we are living in very interesting times, and we're actually going to get into that. So after we, just to let you guys know, after we introduce, allow you guys a few minutes to get to know Bob some more, because he really has a fascinating story you'll want to hear. We're going to get into a couple news items of the day. One is Trump's executive order preventing online censorship, as well as kind of the protesting and the violent protests surrounding George Floyd, and what Bob's take is on that as a Christian, as a pastor. He is a pastor of apologetics at Skyline Church in San Diego as well. And so just really excited to get his take on that. So please stick around for that. So Bob, if you wouldn't mind just kind of giving us the cliff notes of your childhood, where did you grow up, and what was your family life like? Did you grow up in a Christian home?
Okay, well, I was born in Miami Beach, Florida, but from 6 years old on, I grew up in San Jose, California. So I consider myself a Californian growing up. I was not raised as a Christian. I was born into a Jewish home. Now, if you know anything about Judaism, you know that they have three major sects, just as Christianity has 153,000 major different sects. In Judaism, it's called Orthodox, Reform, and Conservative. I was brought up under Reform Judaism. The best analogy I could think of, Ryan, is some of your listeners who consider themselves evangelical or born-again Christians may know others, or even at one time in their life experience going to some church that may even be an old mainline denomination. All the mainline denominations at the turn of the 20th century kind of split. You had a conservative and a more liberal version of them. The liberal version tends to not take the Bible all that seriously. They cherry pick. Jesus may or may not have risen from the dead. They downplay miracles. They downplay sin nature. And so it's very similar with Judaism. If you went to the synagogue under a reformed rabbi, he would probably just talk about something he read in the paper that day. Now, I talk about news also, and even, and I'm a pastor. However, with Judaism, it's different. They just really don't take the Bible that seriously, the Reformed Jews. So I was actually raised as an atheist. And it's very interesting because I became a Christian during my second year of college. It was after I converted to Christianity that I came to the understanding that both the Old and New Testament were the Word of God. I didn't really believe in the Old Testament either. Nevertheless, just to show you the blindness of somebody before they convert, if you had asked me growing up, what's your religion? I would have said Jewish. If you would have asked me, well, what do Jewish people believe? I would have said, we believe in the Old Testament, but not the New. It would have just rattled right off my lips. But if they bothered to ask me a third question, and they seldom did, do you personally believe in the Old Testament? Do you really believe God met Moses on Mount Sinai? Do you believe all the Bible stories, Adam and Eve? And I would have said, no, no, of course not. They're a bunch of fairy tales. In fact, I don't even believe in God at all. I'm an atheist. I would have said that, and I never would have even thought of it as a contradiction.
Wow.
Because the truth is, Judaism is both a religion and a culture. So in a sense, you could say I was raised as a cultural Jew. Now, in high school, I came to the conclusion, due to some supernatural activity in the occult that I should not have been involved with, and I would discourage anyone to get involved with, but nevertheless, I was. I witnessed the supernatural firsthand and came to the conclusion that there was some kind of God. So you could, at that point, say I was an agnostic. There are two kinds of agnostic. Agnostic, of course, means I'm not sure, I don't know. There's the agnostic that says there may or may not be a God. I was the second kind of agnostic. I believed now that there was a God, but I was agnostic as to who he was. I certainly didn't believe he was the God of the Bible. And then in my second year of college, I had a very unusual experience. This goes back to the year 1973.
Now, hey Bob.
Oh, yeah. Feel free to interject.
Yeah. Can I ask you, and if you don't, if you're not comfortable sharing it, that's totally fine. But what was the, because I want to get to, I'm excited to get to what your experience with the true God was like. But if you don't mind me asking, what was your activity in the occult where you had that? What exactly was that activity in the cult where you had that seances, experience?
Seances and Ouija boards. And we actually communicated, we thought, with my sister, who was older than me and had been in a traffic accident and had died when she was 21 years of age. And we communicated with a spirit that knew things about our family that nobody in that room other than my younger brother and I would have known. And yet we were not the ones operating the Ouija board or the mouthpieces in the seance. And I was convinced we had actually talked to my sister from the other world. I don't believe anymore that that is true. I believe we were talking to a demon who impersonated my sister.
Wow. Wow. That is, you know, yeah, I've heard a lot of stories about that kind of stuff. I've never, I've experienced a supernatural activity on the Christian side of things. I became a born-again believer at 19, and I think like a lot of kids, I had, you know, a lot of have done weird stuff like that. You're at a sleepover or something like that, but I'd never, ever experienced anything like that. I imagine that probably you had to be pretty freaked out, I would guess, to some extent after.
Well, I wasn't. I actually found the whole thing fascinating, which, and it's that's the lure. What Satan wants to do is he wants to lure people into that. And this could be a whole show.
Sure, sure.
But to just cut to the bone here, I did go home that night and say, look, if there's spirits and supernatural, and if my sister's alive somewhere, then there's a God. And I started praying to him every night.
Wow.
But when I got into college, and at this time I was a commuter student living with my parents in San Jose, California, a new movement broke out called the Jews for Jesus.
Yes.
And I was infuriated by this movement. Now, so infuriated, I made my own poster, Ryan. Now, I'm no artist, not in the visual arts. I couldn't have made a poster back then that would have looked like anything you'd want to pay a nickel for. But nevertheless, I got, this is the days before you could format it on your computer. Again, this is 1973. I bought some construction paper and an old felt pen. And next to the sign Jews for Jesus, I put up a sign that said, how about people for people? I thought that was just brilliant and philosophical on my part.
Very deep.
If you'd have asked me what I meant by it, I wouldn't have known what to tell you. There's a proverb that says the fool isn't interested in learning, only in expressing his opinion.
Yes.
That was me. But that same day, and this is around the time when the Yom Kippur War had broken out, as I mentioned, we were in my English class late that afternoon arguing about who's right in the Middle East, the Jews or the Arabs. You probably can't guess which side I was on. And I'm sitting in the back of the room. My teacher hasn't come in yet. I'm arguing quite vocally. There's a fellow sitting next to me who was a Christian. And I want to give you his profile because he wasn't some holy roller nutcase. He was laid back, down to earth, talked like a normal person. But he did have this great big thick Bible, you know, leather bound, gold plated pages, his name engraved on the front, probably a red letter edition. He calmly turned to the book of Genesis and showed me the story of Ishmael and Isaac. Now, if obviously, you're familiar with this, Ryan, and maybe a lot of your listeners are too. That is supposed to be the story of the second Jew and the first Arab. It's believed, at least, that the Arab ancestry traces itself back to Ishmael.
Right.
So he turned to me and he said, the Jewish-Arab conflict in the Middle East didn't begin after World War II with the United Nations. It began here in Genesis. I was quite taken aback, and I just looked at him. And nobody else in the class is paying attention to us. We're just sitting in the back talking. And I said, do you really believe in the Bible? Very casually, he just said, I believe the Bible is the word of God. I said, really? Everything? Adam and Eve, Noah's Ark, all those fairy tales? He said, yes. I said, well, how do you know it's the word of God? How do you know it wasn't just written by people? He said, I know because I have a personal relationship with God. I said, well, oh, you mean you pray? Well, I pray too. And like I said, at that time, I was praying to some kind of God, whoever you are, whatever you are, if you are, that kind of thing. He says, well, no, I don't just mean that I pray. I mean that I talk to God and God talks to me, just like he talked to Abraham, just like he talked to Moses. Okay, now I'm listening to this guy and thinking this is either some nutcase that needs to be in a padded cell, or this guy has made the greatest accomplishment of all time, one or the other.
Right.
But one thing that's sure, he got my curiosity going. So I just said, just for argument's sake, supposing I wanted to have that same kind of relationship with God where he spoke to me. Well, he knew I was Jewish, obviously, because of the subject that created this conversation. He squirmed in his seat a little bit and he says, well, actually, the way is through Jesus. It turned deathly silent.
Awkward. I didn't say another word to him. Little awkward at that
point. Yeah, just a little awkward. I went home that night, got down on the floor on my hands and knees, and I said, God, all my life, being raised as a Jew, Jesus has been forbidden knowledge. My people have been murdered in the name of Jesus. My people have been persecuted in the name of Jesus. They've been called Christ killers. I said, the one thing I've been told that I can never, ever do, and my dad had been very clear, if anyone in this family ever converts to Christianity, I will disown them and pronounce them dead. That had been made clear to me my whole life. I said, God, I've been told my whole life that the one box I can never open is Jesus. But now today I've been told that the only way I can have a relationship with you is through Jesus. I said, but God, I don't know anything about Jesus. I'm in my second year of college and a little second grader in Sunday school knows more about Jesus than I do. I said, give me some answers. Teach me more about Jesus. the next day, I was out on the campus after class, just sitting on the grass under a tree, drinking a Coca-Cola. Two smiley Christians walked up to me who I'd never met before. It's not the same guy that had talked to me before. In fact, these guys didn't even know him. They claimed that they were taking a religious survey. And if you believe that's what they were really doing, I've got a bridge I want to.
Sure. Yeah. I'm familiar with this tactic.
I didn't buy it for a moment. Yeah. I could tell, because I'd met obnoxious Christians before. I could tell that this was just a more tactful way. They weren't obnoxious. I could tell that in a more tactful way, and I actually appreciated the tact.
Sure.
They were trying to invoke a conversation. But they said, we're taking a questionnaire about religion and philosophy of life and what is the meaning of life. Well, wow. I'm thinking, well, that's about all I've been thinking about lately. And I was thinking, this is kind of a coincidence because I just prayed about this last night. So I happily took the survey. Ryan, they listened to me talk for an hour and a half about the things I believed about life. I'd love to go back through time, be a fly on that tree and listen to what I said because I had no idea what I was talking about. But like most people, that did not stop me. But when I was done and they had listened very patiently, one of them said, do you mind if we share with you what we believe? I said, yeah, sure. I knew we were getting to that. Anyway, go ahead. Sure. Go ahead. Give me your best shot. And in a very calm, very sensible way, they shared how I could have a relationship with Jesus Christ. They didn't say anything particularly persuasive, but when I asked questions, they did offer answers, which I appreciated and found intriguing. I agreed to check out one of their Bible studies. We shook hands. They left. And that was that, or so I thought. Suddenly, I was bombarded. And it had started a little bit while they were talking to me, but it really increased in intensity when they left. I was bombarded by this experience. I was just very aware that a loving supernatural entity of some sort was probing my insides.
Wow.
The best I could have described it was that it was something out of Star Trek. Yes, that was popular even back then. That's how long Star Trek has been around. Okay. And but it came in the context of them talking about the Spirit of God, the Spirit of Jesus. I suddenly realized that this is what they were talking about. And of course, I should say that in the year prior to this, apart from anything about religion, because you mentioned that I'm a writer, the things I was writing about, the things I was reading about, I was really coming to grips with the selfishness of human nature, which is exactly how the Bible defines sin, as selfishness, not positive self-esteem. God wants us to have positive self-esteem, but the kind of selfishness where we're putting ourselves first.
Right.
Where if the hips are down, the kind of selfishness which says Bob takes care of Bob. I came to the conclusion that even though I had never broken the law and I'd always grown up thinking of myself as a good person, I wasn't that good of a person. Because even when I did something that I thought was a noble thing to do, if I gave money to some charity and I'd pat myself on the back, I'd start thinking, well, did I really do that because I care about these people, or did I do that just to clear my conscience? And I had never examined myself that intensely before, but this had been going on really for a year, and it all was just climbing. So when they shared that selfishness is what the Bible calls sin, and that's what Jesus died for, but they talked about him coming into your heart, and I couldn't relate to what they were talking about. But when they left, I suddenly realized this is the Spirit of Jesus. More correctly put, the Holy Spirit, the third person of the Trinity, but he's described as the Spirit of Jesus too in places. Now, at first, Ryan, I just thought, well, that's great. I mean, now I'm going to have more peace, and there really is a heaven. And yeah, I've been concerned about my sin. My sin is forgiven on the cross, so I'll just live my life, continue with my plans. And my plans were to go into theater, maybe go out to New York someday, try to sell some plays on Broadway. That was it. That was really all that I wanted to do. And I thought that was the end of it. But it wasn't the end of it. In fact, what was interesting is even while these guys were talking, I remember saying to them, these were almost like test statements that I was throwing out to see their reaction. I said to them, even if I were to buy into this and come to the conclusion that Jesus is real, there are three things that you'll never catch me doing. I said, first, I will never set foot in a church. Because the day I do that, I'll be disowned by my dad.
Yeah.
I said, second, you won't catch me reading the Bible. Because frankly, I've opened up parts of the Bible before and read parts, and I found it boring and I found it confusing. I said, and third, I will never, ever, ever do what you two are doing right now, which is going around telling other people about Jesus. Because I think people should keep their religion to themselves.
Perhaps that's the most ironic of them all, but we'll get to that.
The most ironic of them all, absolutely. But they just kind of patiently smiled, and they actually said something very profound. They said, well, Bob, you're putting the cart before the horse. You're not going to go out and talk to people about Jesus right now because you don't have anything to talk about. Why don't you just accept them into your life and see what happens? All right, at the end of that week, I couldn't put the Bible down. I couldn't get enough of Christian fellowship, and which started by just going to one of the on-campus Bible studies. And I talked so much about Jesus, I made an undergraduate woman cry in my English class. And they weren't tears, they weren't tears of joy. I had all the tact of a lawnmower in a barber shop. And in fact, my English teacher made an unprecedented deal with me. No college student in history has ever been given you this deal, I guarantee you. She said if I would stop coming to class for just 2 weeks, she wouldn't lower my grade, just to get rid of me and keep me out of the classroom.
Wow.
For 2 weeks. My voice projects louder than I sometimes realize. I'm the kind of person that if I'm at a restaurant, I'm talking, someone says, shh, other people are listening. I don't realize how loud I'm getting. I'd be out on the quad on the campus thinking I was talking to one person about Jesus. Suddenly I'd turn around. There's like 10 people frozen in their tracks listening.
Wow.
Now, my parents were not too overwhelmed by my decision. When they found out that I became a Christian, I was disowned by my father, pronounced dead, and asked to leave home. That is a situation that never changed. My dad passed away many years later in the year 2001. We never reconciled. Kicked out of the house. I would say that I worked my way through college with part-time jobs, found a roommate to live with, but you know, I actually look back at that as a very pleasant time in my life where God was providing for me. But so that's a little bit about my story and background.
Wow, that is an incredible story. I mean, a few things of note. It's very interesting how your occultic experience, your demonic experience, backfired on the devil. And I think that's a lot of reasons, you know, from what I've heard from people that are from Africa, especially, is that the supernatural is very apparent over there a whole lot. Like, nobody has a problem believing in spirits, believing in demons, or anything like that. But they kind of lay low over here in the States because they know that what, you know, if someone has a supernatural experience, even an occultic one, even a demonic one, it's going to wake them up and go, oh my gosh, this materialistic, naturalistic kind of belief and lifestyle that I'm holding on to isn't actually true. And so in your instance, it's fascinating how your occultic experience, as opposed to doing what the devil wanted, which was lead you into more occultic experiences, actually encourage you to turn away from that and seek the Creator.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Ryan. I guess to put it in a popular phrase today, God took the lemons and made lemonade out of it.
Yeah. No question. And it's you know, and the three things that you said you would never do, you know, go to church, reading the Bible, and you know, do what those guys were doing, and particularly the reading the Bible, because that is such a common experience. I remember watching a Billy Graham crusade, an old Billy Graham crusade on YouTube. I think this was when Billy Graham had, right after he died a few years ago. And kind of randomly, I'm you know, from the Houston area, and I saw my weatherman, Neil Frank, who at the time was the head of the National Weather Service. He got up and he started sharing his own testimony. I was like, oh, okay. I'm not surprised that he was a Christian, because Neil Frank was just such a sweet spirited, kind man, and you could tell that even through his broadcast. But he got up, and one of the big parts about his experience is that he had read the Bible before he came to Christ. And it was just, and I can testify to this myself, it was nothing. It was, you maybe read, the first verse and you were bored. But then after conversion to Christ, after you have received the Holy Spirit through faith in Jesus Christ, it's difficult to explain to someone who's never experienced it, but it's like it came alive, and it became the very thing that it became the thing you wanted to read least, to then the thing you could not get enough of. And that's what it sounded like, what happened with you.
That is exactly right, Ryan. That's very well put.
It's really great, because you just see that testimony over and over and over and over again. So it's exciting to see that. And so here you are. You're a born again believer. Let's move into your professional life. Like, how did you or maybe what would be next for you? You become a believer. Then what's next? Where does Bob Siegel go from here? We'll say, post college.
While I was in college, the first thing I wanted to do, I was led to Christ in the days of the very popular Hal Lindsey book, The Late Great Planet Earth. Every Christian thought Christ was coming any day. I didn't know if I was even going to be here in this world another whole year.
Wow.
I wanted to immediately quit college or maybe go to a Bible college. Interestingly enough, the people around me right away felt I was called to ministry. And they discouraged me from going to a Bible college, which is very unusual, because generally speaking, somebody who's going to college, especially since this was just junior college at the time, when it got time to my last 2 years, I could transfer anywhere. They discouraged me. They said, you should get a regular degree from a college that'll have more credibility, even in the secular world. Prepare yourself for another possible line of work, just so that you don't go through life thinking, well, you're a minister because you don't know how to do anything else. And that was very unusual advice, but that's what they encouraged me to do. So I graduated San Jose State with a degree in drama, which had been my only other interest. And I should say I lost a lot of interest in drama for a long time, but it slowly became resurrected, you could say. And I went to work for a group called Campus Ambassadors, which was part of an organization that's now called Missions Door. They're affiliated with the Conservative Baptist denomination. I'm actually with a Wesleyan church now, so I'm kind of an interdenominational kind of guy. The Wesleyans and Baptists are quite different in a lot of ways, but
sure.
That they were related to the Baptists, and they had this program. It was a lot like Campus Crusade for Christ or InterVarsity or Navigators, except that those are far more well-known groups. And what they would do is they would put you on staff. You had to have at least a Bachelor of Arts to get on staff. So even though I wasn't going to Bible college, these same people were saying, however, if you get a regular degree from a regular college, we will put you on Campus Ambassador staff with your BA. And then what they did is Campus Ambassadors had something somewhat akin to a scholarship, where they would send you to and pay for your seminary education. But your seminary education would only be in the summertime. And then this part of this same degree in seminary would give you a lot of activity units, because when you get a seminary degree, they have internship units, et cetera, for the work you're doing on the campus. So what happened with me is I graduated San Jose State University and then was placed at Arizona State University to work under the directorship of a ministry already established. What Campus Ambassadors did is you served as an intern, or they called it associate staff, for 2 years under an established ministry. After you got your training there, then you could go and find a campus of your own and start your own ministry. So I did 2 years at Arizona State. Then I started and directed for 5 years a ministry of my own at the University of California in Santa Barbara. And corresponding with those 2 years at Arizona and the first 2 years in Santa Barbara, I went to Denver Seminary, moved out to Denver each year, took five classes, which, those classes were done in 5 weeks in the summertime. Had I done them the conventional way during the year, they would have been 9 weeks. So it was an awful lot of information just crammed into us in a short period of time. And so with those 4 summers corresponding, it was a 4-year experience at seminary that resulted in a 2-year degree, a Master of Arts degree from Denver Seminary. So that is how that happened. Later on, I trained some people to take over my ministry in Santa Barbara, and I wanted to start an all-campus church. Campus ambassadors would connect with other established Baptist churches. And I was taking the view of, boy, you know, it's hard enough to defend the name Christian out on campus. Do I really have to go out and take on the name Baptist too? And so I wanted to just start my own church. So then I moved to where I'm living now, to San Diego. And I started a church called Sojourners Christian Fellowship at UC San Diego. Did that for a few years. And then kind of continued doing that in a part-time capacity. But with Mission to the Americas, I made another category change. They had different categories of ministry. I ended up being in 3 of them, campus, new church, and then I was in specialized ministry. I became their national evangelist, traveled around the country to churches and campuses, and I would offer 1 of 4 things, seminars, formal debates, one-man drama presentations, where I would do a dramatic reading of a full-length 2-hour play that I wrote myself that they're sometimes done with full casts, but I would offer versions where I did all the voices myself. And then I did what was called outdoor open air evangelism, where I'd be out in the free speech area. And this is for the guy who is never going to go. I mean, I know a lot of people go to Billy Graham or used to go to Billy Graham crusades and those kinds of things. And they're wonderful. They do great work, but there are a lot of people face it that are just never going to go to something like that.
Right.
But you're talking by the fountain in the free speech area of a campus, and anybody could walk by and just hear you. But right. It wasn't preaching. What we did is we made it an all Q&A time. I would tell the Christians in the group, I'd say, let's start this by you asking me questions. And don't be fake. Don't pretend that you're a non-believer. Just you as Christians have all kinds of questions. Or just say, hey, Bob, a friend of mine always asked me this. Be real. And if for about 30 minutes – these people that are coming by to check this out see me answer your questions with respect in a friendly way, not in a condemning way, then maybe they'll feel free to ask questions of their own. So when I would go out to a campus for a week or so, I might offer any one of those 4 things or all of them. Sometimes if they had me for a whole week, there would be a drama, there would be a formal debate with maybe a professor. A lot of times the professors don't like to do debates. They love having their captive audience in class, but they don't sure. really like being challenged.
Sure.
But you can always find someone from the atheist or humanist society that'll come out and do it if the professor won't. And then sometimes they'd have me speak on their retreat as well. So it gave me a chance to use all the different kinds of gifts that I feel very blessed that God has given me. So you could say that was an eclectic ministry, and that later on transferred into this eclectic radio show, as we're calling it.
And so... how from there? Well, I have a couple questions. For one, I think probably a lot of people are wondering because they hear yeah. that you engaged in like debates with atheists and so forth on campus. What is it like? Is that nerve-wracking? Is that like it? Because to those of us, I've done that one time, but it was actually in a Sunday school setting with an agnostic friend of mine, and it was all written out beforehand and stuff, so it wasn't like an impromptu debate. It was still kind of nerve-wracking for me, but what is that like going into an open forum like that and debating atheists? Bring us into that experience, if you would.
Yeah, well, they're very different. In the open forum, it's just very informal, and it just depends. Sometimes people want to yell and scream their head off. Other times it's very friendly. Sometimes you answer one person's question, then somebody else asks one. There are times when you spar back and forth, but that's very informal. I'm very comfortable with that. Now, there also were in what we call formal debates. This one was not outdoors. This was, they would rent an auditorium. And I should say, on college campuses, debates were the hottest ticket in town because they seldom see them anymore. These days, college students are taught what to think, not how to think. That's a generalization. It's not true everywhere, but it's true in a lot of places.
Sure.
So for these debates, a lot of people would come. There we would have a moderator. It would be timed. Both I and my opponent would get an opening 15 minutes and then a 10-minute rebuttal, time for cross-examination, conclusion. Then we'd take questions from the audience. If a question was directed at me, when I was done answering, my opponent would answer it. So those were very formal. So you could call it, you could call all that debating, but there's quite a difference between a formal debate. Obviously, you feel more adrenaline. Well, actually, you feel the adrenaline either way, because with the formal debate, at least everybody that's in the room wants to be there. When you're talking outside, you never know who's going to show up.
Oh, yeah.
And somebody could come by and blame you for everything Christians have done since the Inquisition to the PTL club, and they've never even met me. And you have to learn to not take that personally.
Right, right, exactly.
Whereas a formal debate, it's kind of like, well, there's going to be a winner, there's going to be a loser. And even though they weren't scored, you know that it's still, sure. You know, you listen to the buzz of the audience, you know that it was understood who won, who didn't win. So they're very different in preparing.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, I think they're great. Yeah. William Lane Craig, the famous apologist, he learned early on in his career that debates were really the way to draw a big audience of unbelievers, and that's why he has made debate such a big part of his career. And even with open air preachers, I know Ray Comfort, a very famous open air preacher from your neck of the woods, he has said, gosh, I wish I could do his accent, but you know, oh, don't worry about hecklers. Hecklers are great. Hecklers draw a crowd. You know, I mean, he loved hecklers because, you know, it creates some drama, and people love drama, and it kind of helps draw a crowd and stuff, you know.
I may not be quite as fond of hecklers as he is. However, I do see what you're saying about drawing the crowd. There's been times I wanted to go up to somebody and say, hey, if I gave you $5, would you come out here and yell at me again tomorrow like you did today?
So. Well, no, that is fantastic. Well, I want to real quick talk to us for a minute about, you're also a playwright as well.
Yes.
Take us into that a little bit. What drew you into that, and how many plays have you written?
I have written 14 full-length plays,
wow,
all of which I've performed myself. About one-third of them have been performed with full cast. Some I directed myself. Justin Parks, no stranger to your radio network.
Absolutely.
He was the one, of course, that introduced us. He and I first connected because he and I were both involved with Christian Community Theater, which had a subset called Christian Youth Theater. Now, Christian Youth Theater over the years became better known. They're the biggest youth theater in the country. They have branches everywhere. But they also had what you'd call the adult theater, not adult in the sense of the way it would look in a video store on Netflix, but you know, plays for adults. And so I had performed my play, The Dust of Eden, for 200 people, staff and patrons at Christian Community Theater. Paul Russell already knew me. They used to have a little publishing house called Russell House Publishing, where they'd published a couple of my plays, put them in catalogs, those kinds of things. But we hadn't connected for a number of years. I was kind of reintroducing myself. So I performed my play, The Dust of Eden, and then it went over really well. And so they agreed to let me direct a production of it for Christian Community Theater. Justin played the lead, did a phenomenal job.
No surprise there.
And that was the story of a person who's told by an angel that he has one day left to live, and the decisions he makes on that one day. And there are flashbacks to his high school and college years. The man's about 25 years old. So he's a very young person.
Yeah.
And when the angel tells him he has one life to live, he says, but my life hasn't even started yet. And the angel says, oh, well, when were you planning on starting? So it kind of takes that tomorrow never comes approach. The best way I could describe my plays is in Act One, you feel like you've watched a comedy. And I'm happy to say, having done them before audiences around the country, people are just laughing hysterically. And then as Act Two begins, and it was a little foreshadowed in Act One, it gets more and more serious, more and more intense, and it has an extremely serious ending. I guess it's what they used to call the tragic comedy, or sometimes the comic tragedy, depending on the proportion of each. I love that style. I remember growing up, since you were asking me what interested me in this, I always loved television. I always loved movies. And there were certain films that I saw, particularly the musicals. They're my favorites. And there were some that I saw, like Fiddler on the Roof, like Cabaret, like Camelot, where I was just so entertained, and yet they had very serious endings. And I remember, Ryan, my response walking out was that at first it was like, well, what a bummer that it didn't have more of a happy ending. But when I noticed something, those movies that didn't have the happy ending, as the years went by, I thought about them more. Mm. I was intrigued by them more. Sure. I wanted to watch them again more than the ones with the happy endings. And everybody loves a happy ending, including me. But I tried to put my handle on why do I like this combination? And I finally realized, because it makes me think. Yeah. So when I write something, I don't want to connect all the dots for people. I may do that when I'm sharing apologetics. But when I get into the arts, I love the fact that I can let people use their own brain and think it through. Some of my stories, I don't want people to think that they all have unhappy endings either. They don't. They're what I'd call bittersweet. Some things are resolved. Some things are not resolved. You're happy. You're sad. You're feeling this mixture, this roller coaster of emotions. And Ryan, that makes people think. And so when we would do my plays out on campus, like there was another one I did called Eternal Reach. We used to do that at UC Santa Barbara in a different formal lounge in the dorms every single week. We would have non-Christians come up to our information table at the university center and say, can you tell me when the next performance of Eternal Reach will be? We had the unbelievers bringing their unbelieving friends to see it, because we didn't hit them over the head.
Yeah.
We didn't come out at the end and say, okay, now here's how you accept Christ. It wasn't like a Billy Graham movie. And I love Billy Graham. I admire Franklin Graham so much. I'm not a big fan of televangelists. Billy Graham, I always thought, was first rate. Having said that, in the Billy Graham movies that they used to put out in the 70s and 80s, you always knew how it was going to end. Somebody was going to turn on the TV and they were going to hear Billy Graham preach and give their lives to Christ. And sometimes they had really interesting stories up to then. We didn't want to do that. We didn't want a package deal. We didn't want it to be the kind of thing where our students would say, I want to invite you to a play and it's free. And then they get there and they go, oh, so this was to convert me.
Right.
We want it to be something they could go to and it ends. But that doesn't mean it wasn't going to talk about God. And that doesn't mean it wasn't going to talk about sin. It did, only we used that word that hooked me, the word selfishness. Everybody knows what that is. You mention the word sin, nobody knows what you're talking about. They think, well, I don't smoke, I don't drink, I don't sleep around, I guess I don't sin. But that's, you know, those may be, some of those things may be examples of sin, but it's our selfishness, that evil side of the nature that the Bible's talking about. And people would hear about that, and I would tell people, bring your friends, and we're not going to club them on the head. However, your friends may want to go out for a cup of coffee afterwards and talk about it. We would give out response cards that would say, how did you like this? Would you be interested in meeting somebody to talk to you more about this? And we led people to Christ through those plays, but they were what I would call pre-evangelism, which I found very, very important from somebody that had all that tactlessness early on in my college life. I learned that tact and was really able to incorporate drama as part of it.
Wow, that is simply incredible. Now, is there a way that we can watch some of your past performances? Do you have those up on your website, bobsiegel.net?
You know what? Unfortunately, those don't transfer very well to video. Now, they might better today because we have better technology today. But in the past, somebody would bring some video camera and you really lose that magic. There was a more professional video of those four stages of ministry where I mentioned seven, where you see me doing some seminar, some open air. and a little bit of drama. And I said, on the drama, focus more on the audience and the reactions of their faces instead of some weird guy up there with those unusual expressions. Because again, it was a dramatic reading. And the interesting thing is, I'll tell people, I'll get out there and I'll always give the same disclaimer. I said, I'm going to do like 10 different voices, men and women. I said, now I don't do women very well. And I'm really proud of the fact that I do women really well.
Not real gender fluid.
With women, what you're going to just hear me do is just maybe lower my voice. Just talk a little more gently like that.
Right.
That's all I'm going to do. And I said, and it's going to look really weird for 5 or 10 minutes. But then what will happen is your imagination will take over. And I'm basing this on what I've heard people say to me for years and years. The imagination takes over and people say, I no longer saw you up there. I actually saw those characters.
Wow.
So
what a compliment.
We do have a promotional video that it was made years ago. It's very dated, but we do have a copy of that somewhere. I've been meaning to put that on my website just for posterity's sake. I do offer these things still. When I talk about it as if it's in the past, it's because while I was working with that organization, Mission to the Americas, and was very involved with these campus ministries, I was doing this thing a lot. I still do that occasionally by invitation. But at the moment, there's no video. Now, some of those plays are published. If somebody goes to my website, bobsiegel.net, and they click into the drama section, you can read a synopsis of each play. In some cases, see the artwork of the original poster we did. In the case of some of them, particularly the ones that were done with full audiences, you can read some reviews. And a few of those have been published on Amazon.com.
Oh,
two
great.
Of them that I already mentioned, Eternal Reach and The Dust of Eden. So you can certainly get a copy of the script. You can certainly read it. Now, if you want to just listen to one, you talked about my radio sketches. There's one that was about 15 minutes that we used to take on the road, with just a couple of actors in it. It was a short little 15-minute one. We did a radio version of that, and that you could hear by just going to the radio section. And it was about Satan as a defense attorney representing Adam, as in Adam and Eve, and suing God because he made them vacate the Garden of Eden. And it's a little play on words. If you have to look at the title carefully, it's called Lou C. Ferguson, Attorney at Law. So it's L-O-U.
Oh, nice. Nice.
And then C, like the middle letter C, and then Ferguson. If you look at it carefully, of course, I'll let your audience figure that out. I'm sure they already have by
now.
Sure,
sure.
And because you could listen to the all audio version of that off my website. Now, that particular one, although I have done that as a one-man too, that's my son playing the defense attorney and a friend of his playing Lucy Ferguson. But you can at least listen to one of my plays. Much shorter. But now that one's a skit. That's like something you'd see on Saturday Night Live. I would call that a sketch. I wouldn't call that a fully developed drama. But that one's all comedy from start to finish. But yeah, that's at least one quick sample anybody could go and listen to right now if they wanted to.
Oh, well, that is fantastic. I'll just say, Bob, you're a man after my own heart. I love all of these things. The audience doesn't know this, but I do some acting and voice work and that kind of stuff on the side. And all of this stuff, you know, doing voices and all of that and incorporating multiple into a single production is just, I absolutely love that kind of stuff. So please visit Bob's site, Bob Siegel. .net, S-I-E-G-E-L, bobsiegel.net. Check out the drama portion of that and the radio portion of it, and definitely listen to those. And I'll have the links to Bob's site in the show notes as well. So, Bob, why don't you tell us then how you got into quickly here, if you wouldn't mind. We're coming on about 56 minutes. So if you would kind of just quickly tell us how you kind of got into radio and how long you've been doing your radio show.
Well, for many years, concurrent to all this time that I was out on the campuses, there were times I was invited to be a guest on a radio show. One time somebody heard about a debate I had done at ASU, they wanted to have me on. So I was on a lot of radio shows here and there on various stations around the country. Sometimes I happened to be in town doing evangelism, they'd have me at the studio, other times I'd call in. But we're going back to the year 2004 now. I was starting to want to get into talk radio, and I really didn't know how to go about it. And I honestly made no effort other than the fact that in my morning prayer walk, I used to live by Santee Lakes out here in the San Diego area. On my morning prayer walk, just I included as part of my prayer, God, I just like to somehow get on the radio. I should say I'm not very good at promoting myself. I'm no self-publicist at all. So when I want something to happen, I don't mean to sound super spiritual because I'm not super spiritual. I'm sure I'd say like most people that I don't pray nearly as much as I should or could. But I was at least every day as part of my prayer saying, God, I'd like you to get me on the radio someday. And this is a story almost as amazing as the testimony I shared. One day, some people that were part of a very small church I was attending at the time, actually a home church, they sat me down. They said, we want you on the radio, and we want to pay for the airtime. And the wow. first place they found me was a show that was already on the air, but they had several hosts. And it was a 1 hour a week. They had several hosts. It was on our local Christian station. And the hosts would either sometimes be on together or other times rotate. And they offered to sell us 1 week out of the month. So I did this. The show had the worst name for a radio show I've ever heard. It was called the Help Save a Friend Hour. It was a great intention. It was like, hey, Christians, we want to help you save your friends. But I always, as an evangelist and apologist, I have to look at those things from the point of view of if I was an unbeliever, would I ever in a million years listen to a show called The Help Save a Friend Hour?
No.
It's almost like you have to give a little disclaimer. It's a title that would make you kicking and screaming. And Ryan, that was the first radio show I was on. I did that for a year, and then my sponsors were able to just buy enough time to premiere my own show. It premiered on Salem Broadcasting, which usually has twin stations. They here in San Diego, they have it. They have it in Texas too, I know. They have a Christian station, and then they have one that's all political and conservative, and they're owned by the same people. So I was originally on the local station, KPRZ, K Praise for short, as an apologetics show. But about halfway through the year, I talked with the guy that I'm from the station who was my contact person, and we talked about switching me over to KCBQ, their conservative station, because I felt that on the Christian station I was preaching to the choir. That's not always true. I know that a lot of people listen to Christian stations, but I felt like I might be preaching to the choir. I didn't want to switch over to the other one, KCBQ, and then have this limitation, like I can only talk about politics. So I said, well, I'll talk about politics, but can I also talk about God? Can I also talk about the New Testament? And the response they gave me, which I really appreciated, was, yes, feel free to talk about anything you want. Just keep our audience in mind. In other words, realize it, you're talking to a lot of people that just because they're conservative, that doesn't necessarily mean they're religious.
Right.
And just because they might be religious, that doesn't mean they may be conservative. You're going to have a lot of conservative Jews listening. You're going to have people that are atheists listening. So I loved that. And so what I would do is every week I would start with a tagline. I'm trying to use the same tagline for my new show on your network, where I start by saying, so you'd like to believe in God, but, and even if the subject's all politics that day, I always start with God. We've got in and out of the conversation. And then again, some weeks God's all we talk about, but I start with God at the beginning, no matter what. And what I'm doing, at least in this show on KCBQ, is I'm giving the audience what they're listening for, but I'm also giving them stuff of where I want to take them by bringing God into it. And I love that combination.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wow. So you've been doing that show now since 2005, I guess.
2005 was when I did my own. So from 2005 on, I've been doing the Bob Siegel Show every week. If we add in that other year with the Help Save a Friend Hour, that's even more weekly radio.
We all get our start somewhere.
If you go to my resume on my website, you'll notice it doesn't say Bob started on the Help Save a Friend Hour.
Yeah, I guess that,
somehow never felt the leading of the Holy Spirit to put that one on there. Actually, they were wonderful people on that show, and they, you know, their hearts and their intentions, and they did a really good show. I just wasn't around when they named it.
You would. It would have been nice if you could have been there. Well, I can tell you as a performer and someone who started my own network and so forth itself. You know, it's beginnings can be pretty humble. But you're of course thankful for them because at least you get your feet wet and then you can kind of move on to kind of more of what really.
I'm very thankful. Had I said, can we call it something else? And they had said, do you have any ideas? I would have started with, oh, just off the top of my head, anything except the Help Save a Friend Hour, where people will run kicking and screaming out of the room.
I hear you, brother. I hear you. Well, man, that is a fascinating story. I can't express to the audience and to you, Bob, and to God, how grateful that I am that you have decided to join the CGM Radio Network and do a weekly show. For now, you know, the schedule is going to be Bob's show is going to be coming out on Mondays. And so to subscribe to the show again, you can go to cgmradio.com/Bob, and you can find links to subscribe on the major podcasting platforms, or you can just search The Bob Siegel Show in your favorite podcasting app. There's a logo with a microphone and his tagline, making the obvious in there. You could just search for it and find it that way. Click subscribe. If you like it, please leave a 5-star review and give a rating. I promise you will. We've got 2 episodes right now. You can listen to those back 2 episodes. They're there at cgmradio.com/Bob. So definitely please check those out. Well, now I want to do kind of what was promised, Bob, and give people a little taste of kind of what, from a news perspective at least, what they might hear on your show. We're hitting about an hour 5 minutes. I try to keep the shows around that time. So if we would, I just wanted to hit a couple news items real quick for you, for the audience. Two things I want to talk about are the Trump's executive order and the George Floyd situation. What do you think about Trump's executive order, where he has basically said it's executive order on preventing online censorship? Is this something that you believe is needed? Is it something that you have personally experienced in any stretch? I know a lot of conservatives are very concerned. What's kind of your general take on Trump's executive order on censorship?
Well, I think an honest answer would probably be more nuanced than time allows. So I'll try to do the Reader's Digest version here. On one hand, he's absolutely right. There is censorship on Twitter, on Facebook. It's also on YouTube, on Google. It's everywhere. And it's wrong. And it's certainly against the spirit of the First Amendment. Technically, they're not violating the First Amendment, because the First Amendment forbids the government to control free speech. On Facebook and YouTube, these are privately owned businesses, and they can have any kind of rules they want. If they don't want to let a conservative talk, if they don't want to let a liberal talk, they don't have to. However, and here's where it gets nuanced, when they claim to be an open platform, and they claim to be neutral, but they're not acting neutral, they're not living up to the things they're stating. They also have, due to some kind of regulation that was passed by Congress, that I understand, they've been given certain exemptions that other businesses have not been given. And so when you start adding that to the mix, then I don't really have a problem with somebody saying, live up to what you say you're going to do, or we're going to start critiquing your business with the same standards with which the government or the FCC might get involved with any other business. So I don't have a problem with it, as long as we're carefully defining what the problem is. But we need to be careful as conservatives and not just quickly say they're violating the First Amendment. The First Amendment is violated when the government starts passing laws saying you're not allowed to say this, you're not allowed to say that. So we just have to be really careful. It's a very thin line we're crossing.
Sure, and I've personally had the same kind of issues and gone back and forth about that as well, because as private companies, their rights need to be protected, even if we don't like them. And but I think what you said is really important is kind of making that distinction between a publisher and a platform, whereas a publisher has editorial content and there are different laws governing publishers than there are platforms. And I actually had pulled it up before our interview, but it's 47 U.S. Code 230, protection for private blocking and screening of offensive material. And it's basically in this, I mean, the summary version is just the idea that a computer service is exempt, you know, from liability from what people say on their platform, because they're simply providing the avenue by which for people to communicate. They're not, you know, they're not publishing material. And so I totally agree. Like if Twitter is like, look, we're a publisher, you know, we're like the New York Times, we're like the Wall Street Journal or Fox News or something like this, then yeah, I mean, they can like completely do whatever they want. But if they're going to claim to be a platform and have those government, those liability protections from the government as a platform, then they're regulated differently. So really we have to, if they're acting in a way inconsistent with the law because they're really acting as editors as opposed to just, you know, a space for people to talk, then it seems like they need to be classified differently than what they are. And maybe that's what kind of ultimately is going to happen in this situation.
Yeah, I think I completely agree with you on that, Ryan.
Okay, cool. I wanted to get your thoughts on it because it's, boy, it is raging right now. And I think that kind of like what, and another thing, and get your take on this as well. Bill Barr said in the meeting yesterday, he came out and said that there was really a big bait and switch with these major online platforms, that the way they grew and got as big as they did was because of they were an open forum. And so everybody could get on it. There was free speech, there was freedom of expression and all this. And so they grew and they got huge. And then once they grew and they got huge, well, we began to see the censorship that we're seeing today.
And even when it's not censorship, like even when it's not removed, but they put something on there like this has been fact checked. Listen, I go to these fact check things all the time, and I always have the question, who's checking the fact checkers?
Right.
Because there will be times when they say this fact check, like Trump said this or Trump said that. And of course, Trump's always saying something. So there's always something to check. And I go to the fact checkers and they start by saying this claim is false. And then when they explain themselves and you read the fine print, you find out that it was actually true. And it's kind of like, well, yeah, he did say this, but he emphasized that. And so it becomes very much a matter of opinion. And that's just when the fact checkers are even saying it honestly.
Well, and
who knows how many times they're even being honest.
And it's amazing that the person that Twitter has chosen to be their fact checker, Yoel Roth, is as partisan and leftist as you can get, publicly calling Trump supporters Nazis. And I mean, you know this as well as I do. It's like it would be one thing if they hired a kind of a as neutral as possible political consultancy firm to do something like this. They obviously have the resources for that. Instead, they pick some dude who's this hardcore outspoken leftist, hates Trump supporters, and they make him their fact checker.
Yeah, but Ryan, even if they picked somebody neutral, I believe we'd have the same problem. Let me tell you why, because the word neutral has a new definition too. You talk to people that have left the places like CBS News and have gone to Fox or other places, and you ask them as a way to get into the heads of the people they've worked with, you'll always hear them say, we never viewed ourselves as being liberal. We never viewed ourselves as being on the left. There's such a thing as the extreme right. There's no such thing as the extreme left. Hmm. You have the right, and then you have just the good old-fashioned, moderate, level-headed common sense that any thinking person ought to have. They are so arrogant that that's what they tell themselves. So I, for instance, I meet people that call themselves moderates. Well, look, if somebody on the right is somebody that just says, these are my convictions, they always have been, they always will be, because truth is truth and right is right and wrong is wrong. And then meanwhile, you have the left moving leftward. Then you have somebody that wants to pat himself on the back and say, well, I don't want to be left. I don't want to be right. I want to be right in the middle. Okay, just follow that graph in your mind. As the left moves progressively left, but the right stays on the right, the only way a so-called moderate can keep staying in the middle of the two of them, halfway between, is to keep moving leftward. Hmm. Never so far to the left that he's fallen off the same cliff, but to the left. And so the moderates are on the left too. And you get into statements like left wing and right wing. And yeah, it's just an analogy, but let's go with that analogy, the analogy of a plane. You have two wings. You cannot have a right wing without a left wing. The plane doesn't fly otherwise. Again, that's just an analogy, but that's the problem. So even if it was somebody claiming to be neutral, I wouldn't immediately be convinced that they were going to be that neutral.
I have never heard it explained that way, Bob. Will you just kind of co-host the show with me every week? I absolutely love the insight and appreciate that. I've learned so much from this hour.
Thank you. No, well, I'm honored to hear you say that. I have a great admiration for you too.
Oh, well, thank you so much, man. It's great to have you. So, real quick, there's a lot we could get into with the George Floyd tragedy, and there's some, maybe I'll talk about it next week, about kind of the New York Times versus the Wall Street Journal reporting on it, and just how the Times are just terrible, just terrible. But maybe just to end the show off, what would be your thoughts? Like if you could say, if you had a platform and you could talk to all of America and give them a 1 or 2 minute soundbite on the George Floyd tragedy, What would you say? What would you want to say to the country?
The word that would come to my mind is clarification. We can come to the conclusion that a police officer used brute violence and abused somebody without immediately making an assumption that it was because the person was black. It may very well have been. We do not know that yet. What we do know, watching that video, and we don't see the whole video either. Sometimes you see all the video and it puts things in context, but I would find it pretty difficult, on no matter what the context is, to explain or defend what that officer did. Did the officer do that because he's a racist, or did he do that because he's just some total jerkwad? I don't know, but we don't even have to go there. It was wrong. Second, we can protest police brutality without making assumptions about all police.
Yes.
Third, we can protest without burning down buildings, lighting cars on fire. Now, that should be rather obvious, but it doesn't seem that obvious when you listen to the mainstream media. And it's not just this. We've seen this when Antifa goes out to Berkeley and because of conservative speakers out there. We see this with all these riots. Lately, we're seeing people on TV calling the breaking of glass and the starting on fire and signs that say all white people must die or all cops must die. And they're saying, well, that's their First Amendment freedom. That's democracy in action. That is not democracy in action. That's anarchy in action. And then I hear, well, but there's this pent-up rage. People are fed up. They're angry. And so you hear this obligatory, oh, I don't condone the violence, but we need to understand the violence. No, we can say we need to understand the protests. We can say there's pent-up rage, so people are out there. They're out there with signs. They may even be chanting. They're angry. They're protesting. I can understand that. Somebody goes into a store and starts looting it. That's just exploitation. So we've got to distinguish between real peaceful protests and what we're seeing with the anarchy. We've got to distinguish between what some cops do with what all cops do. We've got to distinguish motive. We can't read somebody's mind just because somebody's of a certain color. We have cases where black officers were beating black suspects. We have people where there's been many violence and many people killed in the middle of an arrest who are white. We don't know yet. Now, if a pattern of behavior comes out and we hear more about this guy and the news is constantly breaking, maybe more has even come out since I sat down to do this interview. We might find out that this police officer had a history of all kinds of racial slurs and racial comments and things. So that would make a difference. But still, the prosecution should be that he used brute force and somebody got killed. At that point, I'm not sure what the motive is. Well, or what the point is of knowing the motive, because if he killed somebody, he killed somebody. He should pay the penalty for that. We may want to know, for the sake of truth, was this racially motivated? I would want to know that, sure. But we don't know that, and yet everybody's talking like we do know that. The mayor came on TV, and he starts in with, well, I'm no prosecutor, but I know this. If that guy was white, he wouldn't be dead. Then he goes on, he says, now I've only looked at a few of the facts.
Unreal. I'm going, well,
he just contradicted himself within seconds. He hasn't seen too many of the facts, but he knows this, and he's the mayor. Now, again, wow. I'm not defending that police officer at all. And if somebody is that much of a jerk, usually people that are that horrible in their actions probably also believe a lot of horrible things. So if the guy also is a racist, in addition to just being a deplorable human being, well, probably your average deplorable human being is a racist also. So I wouldn't be a bit surprised, but I just like to actually know those things before saying those things. I wish that once in a while public speakers would activate their brains before activating their mouths.
What a novel concept. And, you know, and what we see is a pattern of racism on the left. And it's not only a pattern of racism, because if a white cop or a white person does something to a black person, which I don't even really like those labels very much, but it's kind of how we refer to things in this culture. If someone does that, then it's automatically, if a white person does that, it's automatically racism. And what that is actually racism against white people. And that's not to diminish the tragedy at all. But if a black person, if a black cop, let's say, does it to a white person, it's not racism. It's just, it was right. It was whatever. And so the left's obsession with race, everything is about race, because they can use that as a political tool to gin up the masses and so forth. I don't know. I just see this here, and not only that, but when you've got black men dying in the streets of Chicago, in inner cities around the world, with black on black crime, which is far higher, I think it's somewhere in the 90 percentile range, far higher than any other type of crime against blacks. They only care. It only makes the news. It's only important and worth rallying and protesting about when a white person does it to a black person. So what that tells me is that they really don't care about black people. What that tells me is they only care about black people when it promotes their political agenda. That's my rant on it. But
I agree. We have certain people, certain politicians who are just race baiters.
Yeah. Yeah, they absolutely are, and it's sad. It's really sad, because what they're not doing is providing true help to the black community, and it's through what they're doing, and it's wild to read, like, the New York Times, like I did this morning, talking about these protests, and just kind of how, like, casually they talk about police centers just being police stations being just burned to the ground and caught on fire and all the violence. I don't know. It's weird, but the focus is on Trump's tweet, or what, like they condemn Trump's tweet, which if you read it in its context is perfectly fine. But then they talk so casually about the violence and so forth, so almost as if it's justified or whatever. It's just absolutely amazing. Well,
and yet the same people, when people in Michigan want to protest because they're not allowed to open up their businesses and it's a peaceful protest, they mention, oh, well, they were carrying arms. Well, they weren't carrying their arms in Michigan because they were going to use them or threaten anybody. They felt that their Second Amendment rights, along with their first, were being violated. And they were carrying their arms as a show. They committed no vandalism. There was no violence. And yet they were talked like they were the most dangerous things that ever hit. And yet people's cars are being torched. And it's not just stores. There's looting going on. I've heard some say, well, you're comparing the products in the store to a human life. I'm sorry. You burn down a building, you're very aware it could cost a human life. It may not always, but anyone who burns down a building knows that somebody could get killed. That person is a murderer. Even if murder was not the result, they are a murderer in the sense that they were doing something that they fully knew could lead to murder. And they defend that as a First Amendment freedom. When Antifa was going out to Berkeley, it was to get in the way of First Amendment freedom because somebody dared to come out to that campus with a view that wasn't politically correct. And I love these innocuous names, Antifa. Oh, they're not fascists. How do we know they're not fascist? Their name means anti-fascist. So how could they possibly be fascist? So they have these innocuous names, and we're supposed to just roll over and play dead and say that just because they call themselves that, that doesn't mean that that's what they're actually doing.
Right. Well, and just like, you know, Hitler's political party is a National Socialist. Like, well, he really wasn't socialist, you know, blah, blah, blah. So by that same logic, you know, if Antifa truly is.
He was a socialist. They talked about when in the early days of Hitler, you know, people act like they think, well, Hitler just got up one day, grabbed all the Jews, marched them to a concentration camp and killed them. No, he started out very slowly. It started off with redistribution of wealth. They had come out of a depression. It was rich against poor. And then soon they were able to substitute the word rich for Jew because all Jews are rich. I wish as a Jew that were true. It's not. You know, I remember when somebody told in Phil on the Roof, somebody tells Tevye, money is the world's curse. And he looks up at the sky, he says, may the Lord strike me with it, and may I never recover.
Oh, I love that movie. Love it.
Oh, my God. But so it's just nuts the way they're.
Well, and you know, and here's the funniest thing, and this just kind of dawned on me this morning. Maybe this has hit you as well. It's amazing that with these protests surrounding George Floyd, that suddenly they no longer, at least in these instances, care about social distancing. I mean, how many of them are getting up and denouncing the lack of social distancing among these protesters? I would fare to say probably not many.
I will say this, Ryan, when Maxine Waters decided to blame the Floyd thing on Trump, because everything's Trump's fault.
Sure.
If you get a flat tire.
Sure.
It's Trump's
we love fault. Maxine around here.
Yeah, when we had the Ice Age originally, whenever people think that happened and it got melted, that was Trump's fault.
Of course, of course.
Everything's so she's blaming it on Trump, but she was wearing her mask while she was saying it. So she was doing her social distancing while she was blaming Trump. So I've got to at least say that with Maxine Waters, it's still alive and well.
Well, and with the Democrat Party, they certainly have a history of wearing masks, but we won't go into that full detail. It does seem like
that little Ku Klux Klan part of their hair. You notice how they've switched that narrative.
Well, they were secret Republicans.
I'm an independent, just so the audience knows, so I don't call myself a Republican or a Democrat. Obviously, my beliefs lean more Republican when they do what they claim their party's all about.
Sure.
But they were started as the anti-slavery party.
Right.
And the party that was the party of slavery, segregation, Jim Crow, Ku Klux Klan, is the Democrats. And look how they've switched that narrative.
It's amazing.
And they're portraying the Republicans as doing those things. It's incredible.
It truly is. It truly is. Well, we have gone way over time, but I really don't care. That's one of the beautiful things about podcasting, is you can kind of go as long as you want.
It could be as long as you want. Yeah.
Not that people would listen that long.
Are you telling me those long-winded diatribes of mine are not going to get edited down? Is there really going to be a director's cut of this that's available?
Dude, the director's cut is going straight to podcast, so
that's great.
I'm not a big fan.
Some of the times I cleared my throat and make that the super director's cut.
I don't think there was a single time. I'm going to have to go back and edit any of that stuff out. No,
I turned away from the mic while doing it. I should tell your audience, good. I have allergies. They are not the most fun thing to have in radio.
Oh, they are the bane. They are the bane of radio hosts. I've got to say, it's when allergies are really kicking in, you're having to clear your throat a lot. It's no fun. Well, Bob, it has been an absolute pleasure I'm looking forward to having you on again very soon. Actually, we're going to do a show on your book on the Holocaust of Israel, about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And actually at bobsiegel.net, we didn't really talk about that you're an author of several books, but go to his site, you'll see.
Yes, fiction and nonfiction, both.
Of course, the Renaissance man that you are. You can't just stick with one. Have you written any poetry anthologies as well?
I have not. I can't say I've never written poetry. I have written some musicals, so the lyrics in the songs, I guess, would count.
It's just absolutely amazing. A great talent, and I just say
I have a play that was based on the life of the Apostle Paul and his trial before Emperor Nero, and Nero considered himself a musician, and I wrote what was meant to be a horrible sounding song and poem for that play, but that was meant to sound horrible because it was being given by Nero at this banquet where everybody was afraid to tell Nero what they really thought of it, or they'd be put to death immediately. So.
Sure.
As far as apologetics go, there's a book called I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... as if I'd like to believe in Jesus, but what about the people that never heard of Christ? How could a loving God send people to hell? And then my favorite of all the novels I've written, and it was written as a children's novel, but adults have loved it. It's called The Dangerous Christmas Ornament. It does not have to be Christmas for you to enjoy it. That would be one that I'd love to see people check out.
Oh, fantastic, fantastic. And we'll go into that more in... I'm going to be out in your neck of the woods, and we're going to do an interview there with you in San Diego for World News Brief, and I'm quite excited to do that, so looking forward to it. But Bob, thank you for coming on the show. Welcome to the CGM Radio family.
Thank you, Ryan. The pleasure was all mine.
All right, thank you so much. And again, to subscribe to Bob's show, head over to cgmradio.com/Bob or just search the Bob Siegel Show in your favorite podcasting app.